Wednesday, April 6, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. As we think back to Japan and the multiple disasters it has experienced over the last several weeks, we recognize that there is still much unfinished business to do. Of course, there is the rebuilding of the nation, but beyond that, there are immediate crises as well. You might be thinking of the nuclear crisis, where the catastrophe at one of its nuclear plants and several of its reactors continues, even as there is now news about radioactive water going into the ocean there at the site of the nuclear plant. But I'm thinking about something that is far more intense and far more personal and bringing far more grief. The Wall Street Journal reports that there are still thousands of bodies unaccounted for. John Busey, reporting in yesterday's edition of the paper, says that this past weekend, a big U.S.-Japan joint military operation with more than 100 helicopters and planes, 30 of ships, and 18,000 personnel set out to find some of the 15,000 bodies believed lost to the earthquake and tsunami that hit Japan last month. Now, the bad news is that after all of this effort with all these planes and helicopters and ships, only 339 bodies were found. So that leads to an obvious question. Where are all of these missing persons? Where are their bodies? And the reality is that much like what happened in Indonesia several years ago, they were most likely swept out to sea. They most likely never will be found. And that is compounding the grief of so many who were there in Japan. But it's not just that story. Did you notice the juxtaposition of the fact that there is good news in the Atlantic? It's sad news, but still good news that the wreckage of that Air France passenger jet that crashed nearly 2 years ago has been found. It was found roughly 6 miles from the last point of contact with the plane, which leads to many questions about why it took this long for it to be found. But what's most amazing is that of the 228 people who were on board that plane when it went down for reasons still unknown, the vast majority of those bodies have not been claimed, but have apparently been located inside the fuselage at the bottom of the ocean, 2.5 miles beneath the surface. And this has led to a real satisfaction and hope on the part of many people. And yet, when you think about it, does finding a body make one happy? And the answer is yes. And the answer is yes for a very basic human reason that Christians can understand. There is a need for closure. There is a need to know what happened to a loved one. There is a need, indeed, to face death and to face it honestly. Missing is excruciating, even when there is no other alternative than that the loved one has died. And now there are so many families in Japan who are grieving, wondering, how can we adequately grieve when there is no body? And now there are people in France and elsewhere with the folks who are on that Air France jet who are now thinking maybe they can have some closure at long last. Now, from a Christian perspective, why is this so? We need to remember that God made us as embodied creatures. The body is indistinguishable from the self. Even though we believe that we are a complex, a union of the spiritual and the physical, even in the age to come, remember that we will have a glorified body, those of us who are in Christ. The dead will be raised, and there will be a physical existence. We are indistinguishable from our bodies. One of the reasons why Christians have particular habits of burial and funeral traditions has to do with the fact that we believe the body is to be treated with dignity. That's why there have been particularly Christian habits of burial and funeral traditions. It's because Christians understand that we are to treat the body with respect. That is why there's been a strong bias against cremation and a very clear preference for burial. This is why we understand that the body is to be treated with respect, even to the point that shocks many, especially of the young among us, that there is an open casket during the time of visitation where there is the physical, the visual confirmation of the fact that this, yes, indeed, is this loved one who is now died. Well, there are all kinds of things at stake here, but one of them is the fact that we understand that this grieving that is exaggerated and exacerbated, increased by the fact that the body is not present, is something that we, from a biblical understanding, can really, really understand. And thus we sympathize with those who are even just now looking, perhaps almost assuredly in vain, for the bodies of their loved ones. One of the reasons we need to think about this is because we are reminded that Christians do grieve. We grieve death. Death is the final enemy, and Christ himself has defeated death, but it is now a foe whose defeat is not yet evident among us. We still die. We're awaiting the final victory of Christ over death and his return. But in the meantime, we are reminded by the Apostle Paul that to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. But the body is still dignified, and we cannot separate ourselves from that body, nor will we be in eternity. There are so many things going on in the world and in the United States. There are a few things that are likely to get more attention and start more conversation than a presidential election. Every 4 years they come around, and every 4 years it seems that they start earlier, which makes this year all the more interesting, because it's not starting earlier, it's starting later. There is, as of today, only one declared candidate for the office of President of the United States, and he has not made a formal declaration, but has rather sent out the message that he is running because he's got to raise money for his reelection. President Barack Obama on Monday sent out an email and made statements that he is officially announcing his 2012 reelection campaign. Mr. Obama said the race may not reach full speed for a year or more, but he said the work of laying the foundation for our campaign must start today. And as USA Today says, the translation of that message is it's time to start serious fundraising. On the Republican side, there is a very unclear picture about who actually will and will not run. And it is very, very late in the season for that to be so. But we do know this. I think Mr. Obama is wrong when he says it might take a year for this to get at full speed. My guess is it's going to come a good deal sooner than that. It virtually has to. There are some interesting stories out there having to do with controversies in museums. Many people think of museums as places that would be perhaps least likely to incite controversy, but those who watch the culture know that that simply is not true. For instance, the Smithsonian Institution, that massive institution of culture and learning, and the nation's repository, often referred to as the nation's attic. It has 19 museums and galleries, 20 libraries, 9 research facilities, and also includes the National Zoo. Well, it now includes a great deal of national controversy. G. Wang Clough, who was the secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, finds himself in trouble because of a decision he made with an exhibition at the National Portrait Gallery. He pulled a video from the exhibition. It was called Hide and Seek, and it was to examine gay and lesbian themes. And even though he did not pull down the exhibit as a whole, he did take down one video, and that has led to crossfire from the left and the right. As the New York Times says, he is now wounded in a crossfire of a capital culture war. And you need to know it's going to always be like this, because art has always been a matter of cultural controversy. Many of the most famous works of art that we look at and remember from museums and from our understanding of the history of art, many of those were controversial in their own times, and many of them were painted or were created by artists who were controversial on other grounds. The reality is that art conveys a message, and anytime you convey a message, that message is likely to be controversial if it says anything of importance. In the art world today, there is an enormous division between those who see representational art and the more traditional arts as those to be encouraged and supported by tax support, and those who see transgressive art, that's the word used by the postmodernists, as the necessary way that that efforts for freedom are extended. When it comes to themes such as gay and lesbian themes, you can count on controversy, and it's now reached the Smithsonian, but that's not the only controversy. Over the weekend, something else happened, and that had to do with a new exhibition at the Nixon Presidential Library in Yorba Linda, California. There is a new exhibit there that has to do with Watergate, and it is very controversial, or will be, because it is a very straightforward presentation of what Watergate was all about. Now, why is that news? After all, the Nixon Library has been around for 30 years or more. It's because the original Nixon Library presented what can only be described as a rather sanitized version of this horrible controversy and scandal that brought an end to the Nixon administration. And so there are fascinating things going on here. The chairman of the library said this: nearly 40 years after President Nixon left office, Watergate remains a controversial and much-studied subject. And even though he went on to defend President Nixon by saying it's just one chapter of the enormously consequential life and career of the 37th president of the United States, well, he says this new exhibit is one interpretation of the events that led to President Nixon's resignation in 1974. Now, it's going to be interesting to see what the response is to this exhibition. My guess is for most Americans, who are, after all, under age 40, it's going to be something of an introduction to a controversy that older Americans remember all too well, a rather bitter chapter from American history. And whenever there is an issue of consequence, there's going to be controversy. But we need to tell the story as it was, recognizing the limitations of any exhibit or of any author or of anyone who will narrate the story. It is necessary to tell as much of the tale as we can tell. And thus, this new exhibit at the Nixon Library is itself a positive thing. There are a couple of new biographies out you need to know about. One of them has to do with Mohandas Gandhi. Great Soul, Mahatma Gandhi and His Struggle with India by Joseph Lilleveld is out, and it is also controversial. It's been banned in India. It's a basically very positive biography of Gandhi, but it's also very straightforward about what can only be described as some very eccentric personal habits and questionable issues of human sexuality. There is in this biography coverage of the fact that he had a relationship with a German man with whom he had once lived that certainly is sexual in nature if it was not sexual and physical expression. There are other things in the book that are just straightforwardly honest, including the fact that it is almost impossible to know exactly when Gandhi came to some of the beliefs with which he is credited. He's a controversial figure. Andrew Roberts, writing a massive review in the Wall Street Journal that is worthy of note, points out that the Gandhi that we think we know is almost assuredly not the Gandhi of history. It's good for us to remember that it takes time, sometimes a great deal of time, for an adequate account of a human life to be able to be formulated in a biographical form, and it continues a discussion that is almost surely going to extend far into the future. I will tell you this, the closer you look at Gandhi, the more you recognize that there is probably more myth about the man than reality, and certainly it raises all those issues about how you separate a man's teaching from his personal life and the limitations of actually being able to do that. The other very interesting biography that came out this week is Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention by Manning Marable. Mr. Marable himself is a civil rights scholar, or was. He died just a few days before the book was released on Monday morning. The subtitle of this book kind of tells the story. Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. Professor Marable describes Malcolm X as something of a protean man who changed his disposition and his outlook from time to time. It's another very important American life. It's an important American story, and we should welcome an important new biography to add to the conversation. By the way, the most controversial issue of this is that Professor Marable attempted to name the assassin of Malcolm X as Al-Mustafa Shabazz, a man who had previously been known by a different name, and that was William Bradley, and who is a 72-year-old man living in New Jersey. It'll be fascinating to see if this story turns from a biography into a crime novel. Time will tell. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information about Southern Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.